we're focused on a time development of a quantum system, a closed one, so that it is given by a unitary operator. If we have a initial state rho zero, then we have a time development operator U T, which is unitary. Well, it's like this. And first, I'm going to go through some obvious problems that the unitarity of the time development brings about, how we cannot, in a sense, have a thermalization or tendency to go towards some equilibrium state, and how we can, in a many-body system with many close to infinite amount of degrees of freedom, overcome these things and still observe thermalization. So with this unitary time development, the first problem is that we do not have fixed points in the Hilbert space that are non-trivial. So if we have a fixed point, say, such that the operation on this fixed point is the point itself, and we want to say that we have a system that, starting from some arbitrary state, rho zero, develops into this stable state, we can write that an infinite time limit ut of rho zero minus rho final is zero, the difference in some norm. Okay, so if this is truly a fixed point in the time development, we can say that we might as well develop this. Fixed point of this time development. So fixed point.
So you fixed the amount of time t, and it's an eigenvector. I mean, or it's.
It means that for every t.
For every t.
So it's a fixed point of the amount.
Oh, I see. Okay, so. Okay.
So it doesn't matter how much you propagate in time. Yeah. So. And the other point that I forgot to mention about the besides the unitarity, is that this operator is linear. So from this, we may say ut 0 that this has to be 0. And then, since the unitary time development operator doesn't change the norm, we can take it out, and all we're left is just the difference between rho 0 and the fixed point. Well, there is no time development anymore, so we only can go in the infinite time limit to a stable state if we are in a stable state to begin with. So in a we may conclude that there is no thermalization in the sense that in if we measure it with this kind of a norm, we don't proceed into a final state that is stable and doesn't depend on the initial state of the system. And we can't proceed to any such a state unless this is already a stable state, meaning it would be an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian that gives the time development. Okay? So, obviously, we still have some equilibration or thermalization, but we need to have it in a weaker sense than this norm. So if we have some specific observable, we may still see that in an infinite dimensional or in the limit of very large amount of degrees of freedom, these observables tend to some stable state or observational value. So let's say we have some Hermitian operator A, and we want to see how the expectation value of or the measurement outcome of such an observable develops in time. It's given us is this expression.
So the expression on the left, it depends on P, right?
Yes. There's the dependence.
The left hand side is A of T.
Yes.
Now, if you write like this, it looks like the time average. Just put A of T instead.
Okay. Yeah. So, doing the spectral decomposition of this time development operator, we may write this as sum over all eigenstates like this. And then we may separate the part that contains the diagonal elements of our initial state in the basis given by the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. So it would be this, and then the non-diagonal part given like this. And now as the time grows without a limit, one can say that given some, this is only a necessary condition, not, it doesn't always hold, but it's possible that if we have a non-degenerate spectrum, these oscillations tend to cancel out in the infinite time limit, and what we're left with is only the diagonal part or the so-called defaced part. And we can say that if such a limit exists, it is given by the diagonal or defaced part. And even if it doesn't, if this limit exists, we can say that the limit is also the time average, because we reach the limit or go arbitrarily close to it in some finite time, and then we might average over some significantly longer time scale than the time it takes to reach the value within some accuracy. So the time average we always have, and if we have the infinite time limit, it coincides with the time average. And
so the right hand side is the time average, right? Always.
Yes, this is.
Let's say. It's identical to.
Let's put a question mark there to say. Give the fact that it doesn't necessarily exist, but what always exists is yes. And now in infinite dimensional systems we can have this. But already as we increase the system size, we can expect that we see the behavior in some sense going like the infinite time limit. And how we can do this kind of calculation, how we might observe it, is to pick a specific Hermitian observable A, which is only the initial state, and get a quantity called Loschmidt echo, which is defined as this, or if you want to write it in terms of wave vector, since we're in a pure state, we can always write the initial state in a in this way, and in the state vector representation, it would give us the overlap between the initial state and the state we are in at some moment t and its absolute value squared.
Can I ask a couple of questions?
Sure.
The assumption that you can take the infinite time limit depends on system size, because if you have degeneracies, right, or quasi-degeneracies, which are exponentially small in system size, then it would take a time that it's exponentially large in system size.
Yes.
Now, okay, so it means that there are some N and M states which your density matrix is not going to become diagonal, right, in that case, because these energies are almost there. But if the operator A is a local operator, you maybe hope that if you have two energy levels which are really degenerate, we have probably, there's no matrix element via A, which is local. Otherwise, you could maybe say it's too big for degeneracy. But the row zero, that could be a non-local operator, right? If you take an initial density matrix, that that not necessarily is a local operator. So in that case, I don't know if
that thing may exist or not.
Yeah.
But it may, can only exist in the infinite dimensional case. It cannot exist for a finite dimensional system. It's quasi-periodic, the system. So it comes back to itself almost.
Yeah, but if the energy levels are incommensurate, that time could actually, it could diverge in system size as well, or it doesn't return time.
Yes.
Yeah, so it can, for the finite system, it's finite though.
That's not so obvious, right? If you have two incommensurate periods.
Quasi-periodic. So it means that in a finite time can get arbitrarily close.
Mm-hmm. So, quasi. Yeah. But even in the stronger case where you do the time average.
Yeah.
Because then in the time average.
The time average always exists.
Always exists. Well, you have to be careful with the order of limits, right? If you do the time average, if the limit of this capital T is very large, but how large does it have to be? If it goes to infinity first, before you take system size to infinity, you kill the off-diagonal elements. But if T is, that time can be exponential system size.
Yeah, so the time average exists only in the strict sense that T is
infinity first.
Yeah. So the point is that what happens for a finite, so the limit doesn't exist, but this Loschini-Keiko, as the system increases, how does it behave? Does it do crazy things, or does reasonable things, like staying close to the time average?
Mm-hmm.
And so this one.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say that we have initial state given as some in the some linear combination of the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Then we may say that the time average of the Loschmidt echo is given as this sum, or it can be written as let's say. Sort of measure of the impurity of the dephased state. So this statement only gives one whenever we have all but one sees zero and the remaining one, so that we are in an eigenstate. And otherwise this statement gives something between 0 and 1. And always initially 1, because we're starting with a pure state. And, well, if we look into this function of at this stage, just some system as a function of time, it behaves, if I just sketch the behavior and say that equilibrium or time average value is here, it behaves something like this. So it starts off with 1, goes to equilibrium, or the time average state in some time scale, which we call the relaxation time. Then it can or cannot have, but usually it has some sort of kinks that stand out from the background noise it has more or less always that, and the first of them, the time at which we encounter such a kink, we call revival time, and then somewhere in the infinitely distant future, which is basically given as an exponential or even doubly exponential of the systems as we have the recurrence, which is so big that even with a reasonably sized system, it diverges really fast, exponentially. The relaxation time, we say, is related to the spectrum or excitation bandwidth. So we may say that it's the maximum, basically the shortest time scale of the system. How long does it take for the lowest energy state and the highest energy state to get far apart in on the unit circle, so that they are in different phases, and that's when we reach the equilibrium roughly the first time. As said, the T recurrence is something like e to the n, and then these revivals, well, they you could in principle have a setup in which you don't have such things, or you don't, even if you have them, you might not be able to observe them in a way that you can prepare a system so that, for example, the revival time is shorter than the relaxation time. And so it would be somewhere here and it would just go unnoticed. But for the time being, let's assume we observe it, and later on with some specific system we can give some quantitative arguments on when do we measure it and when not. And if we do measure it, it is dependent linearly on the system size, and well, we have a time and the system size, so we can say we also have a speed. And what this speed turns out to be is the speed of interactions, or the speed at which the correlations in the system move in from one place to another. It's sort of just at this point, definition that we define a speed, but later on we can explain it in terms of the excitation spectrum of the system.
So this is the research part, right?
Yes.
How to extract,
yes,
this time scale.
And yes.
And how it's related to the speed of,
yes,
interactions.
Okay. So to study such a thing, we pick a specific model, which is the XY model. Let me write the Hamiltonian, -1/4. So this is a lattice model assuming periodic boundary conditions. So we have in total n numbers, and we assume n plus 1 equals 1 when we do the summation. And well, the sigma operators are just Pauli matrices in their natural representation, and probably the most familiar of this class of models is the case where gamma equals 1, in which case it reduces to transverse field Ising model. The good thing about such a class of Hamiltonians is, well, there are two good things that we know. We know how to solve them exactly, and we know the phase diagram. And, well, let's get first to the part exactly solvable. So we can, with some mathematical, non-trivial, but I think this was done already in the 50s, luckily, way map this system into non-interacting fermions, such that we have creation and annihilation operators that satisfy the normal fermionic commutation relations. And we also know the energies or the dispersion relation lambda k of such a system exactly. It's given as this. So that is the how you solve it. And then the phase diagram, which also is pretty relevant for the study. Let's sketch it here. We have the parameters, H being the field and gamma the so-called anisotropy parameter. So, and when I say anisotropy parameter, I mean that these fermions have a, even though the system doesn't look like it initially, can you all see the uppermost row? They have a preferred direction. So putting gamma to zero, we have an isotropic system, and then we have the usual on the line gamma equals 1. We have the usual Ising model, which has the critical point at field equal 1. And because we want to use this model to solve the Loschmidt echo and extract timescales, we have to put it prepare the initial state in some other state than an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. So what we do is we put the initial state, we define it to be the ground state corresponding to some H1 and gamma 1. And then we take the time development operator to be some given by some Hamiltonian H2, which is described by a different set of parameters, so that this state is no longer eigenstate of the new Hamiltonian. And in this, so in this
quantum quench.
Yes, in this quantum quench, we basically pick a point in the phase diagram and do a jump to a different point and develop with the new Hamiltonian. And well, we can solve the state exactly. Going into momentum space, so this k is now just a variable defined as I used j there already, so let's say it's 2 pi n over n. And this is the initial state, and now that we have it, it's easy to compute the Loschmi echo, which is given as this statement. Now we have these creation operators corresponding to the new system. So let's, for the sake of clarity, put there a number 2. And this beta k is a property of the quench. So it is a function of all the gammas and all the fields. So we can label it this way. And this beta gives us a measure of, or the absolute value of beta gives us a measure of which momentum states are occupied and which are not. And if we stay well within a phase, not going near to a critical point, it turns out that we can plot this absolute value of beta, and it turns out to be something like this. The main feature is that there is no state that is overly dominant over the others. And in the critical case, it's quite the opposite. We have, here's pi, we have a sharp peak at some given value, which is dominant over the other excitations, and then something that really doesn't stand out from this huge spike. When we're in phase, we can safely do the approximation that all the betas are equal. It doesn't really change the results too much, but in the critical case, we only excite if we have, let me plot the spectrum here. We have some states given like this, and we want to define the relaxation time. We have the difference of the maximal energy and the minimal energy. We only consider a part of the excitation spectrum, because that is the part that dominates anyways. But in the non-critical phase, we can, or the case where we don't go over phase boundary, we can, or go even near it, we can say that the relaxation time is given us. And put like as this. And the other case, we have to define some cutoff to which states to consider. The more interesting time scale turns out to be the revival time. And it we can say that it's proportional to the system size, and as I said, it's proportional to some speed, and the speed is given as the group velocity of the excitations, so, as I mentioned earlier, that there might or might not be revivals, because this depends on n, and the relaxation time doesn't depend on n. So, the way to get this visible is just to increase the system size in order to make this significantly bigger so that it stands out from the relaxation time scale. And let me just give you some argument on why this can be. Well, first, I write these momentum space operators in the localized space. Yes, it's first we maximize and then we take the inverse, not the other way around, sorry. So dispersion relation basically gives us this how the propagation of these things, and we can demand for this statement to do a little tweak in K, say, and up to first order, we get a little correction to lambda as well. Lambda k 0 plus delta lambda. And then demand that states that are at the in the momentum space neighboring each other, we say that they have to be in the same phase, which gives us that they have to add up coherently, and then solving for T, we get the statement dk d lambda, and then which we might as well call n tilde. So this is the group velocity now. And, well, this holds for practically anything. I didn't say anything about the maximal group velocity. I just gave an argument on why this is somehow related to group velocity. And now this is a first order approximation. So if we plot the dispersion relation, lambda k, and it is something like this, we may do this first order approximation if we take, well, that's a product, but if we consider the oscillations in a logarithm of the Loschmidt echo, it's easier to see because it's just a sum. It's something like a sum over oscillating modes times something which is goes like beta k, And then we have the sinusoidal things. This approximation, if we do it for a certain region, it's valid up to second order, but wherever the second derivative of the system of this dispersion relation vanishes, it's valid up to third order. So we get peaks corresponding to the maximal group velocity, and depending on the H2 and gamma 2, we might have local extremas in the sense that the second derivative vanishes here as well, and we can see the revivals corresponding to them as well. But since the biggest group velocity always comes first, it is the most, it stands out from the background, and the rest may not be as clear. But the first one is always given by the maximum group velocity when these modes add up coherently. And that's basically the interpretation for the revival time scale we have done. And another thing why this is good to have such a result, not only because we have some sort of intuition of what's behind all this, there is also a previous result on Leib-Robinson bounds on these kind of systems, and these are bounds that theoretical bounds that give a maximal speed of these interactions. And for a transverse field Ising model, we can say that the bound for a Leib-Robinson, the Leib-Robinson speed for interactions is, or the bound for the interactions is given by the square root of h. And if one looks at the dispersion relation, we get a result that supports this statement, and also the interesting thing that that if we plot the Leib-Robinson bound, it's given as the square root, and when we plot the maximal derivative, we not only get something that is strictly smaller than the theoretical bound obtained earlier, but we see that at criticality, this bound is tight, so that this is the maximal group velocity, and this is the Leib-Robinson bound. So that's basically one of the main results that we get is the tightness of the bound, and it's
and the revival time.
Yes.
Really,
I'm already over time, so I think that's the essentials. And yeah, if you have questions, go ahead. There are a few simple arguments. One is that if we increase the system size, the spacing in momentum space goes down as 1 over n. Another thing we can do is to take a spin flip operator that is a, say we take the original spin operator and then do its time development, we get that the result is, well, if this is in some site J, we have a sum over, like this. So, and these, of course, depend on the time. So one can see how these wave packets travel around. And it, you can obtain the same kind of argument on the speed is constant, but then you just have a bigger lattice. So basically, you can say that this gives you a speed, and then you just want to see the point where if the original excitation is at site J, when do they reach the opposing site on the lattice that they add up coherently. So that's another justification or motivation for it.
Do we have interesting revivals also in other observables, or just in this global? So the Loschmidt-Echo is counting all the possible revivals, right, in every observable. But
well,
but do we have some particular observable that is interesting that has a revival?
Well, we have at least two, and I would expect that if you would compute other observables, you would get the similar behavior. But I can say that the average magnetization is one of them, and it behaves as the logarithm of the Loschmidt echo. The equilibrium value is not the same, of course, but we have something that is first order in this betas as the oscillation amplitude, and the time scales are similar. And also, if one would take the density matrix of the whole system and trace out everything except for the one spin and calculate the entropy of that, we would also get the same oscillation frequencies and amplitudes that are behaving in the same way as the betas there. So that's at least two observables, I think the two easiest ones to compute. And yeah, I expect that if you would do it for more observables, that would be the general behavior you would see.